Welcome to C-Theory Live. Today we're really fortunate to have Professor Taiaki Alfred, who's from Indigenous Governance at University of Victoria and is actually Indigenous Peoples Research Chair in Indigenous Governance, and coming in to talk with us really about insurgent forms of resistance and activism. And it's really wonderful that Tai is here to talk about this, because Tai is a Mohawk, like an authentic Mohawk philosopher and a political activist, and he's written really three important books. The first book was Heeding the Voices of Our Ancestors, followed by Peace, Power, and Righteousness, and the third text, which is Wasasse, Indigenous Pathways of Action and Freedom. And they're all really important texts. And so today, Mary Louise and myself would just like to ask Taiaki some questions and really just have a common reflection on Indigenous forms of resistance and what the meaning of warrior culture in a world which is increasingly militant on behalf of the language of empire itself. Mm-hmm. So, Mary Louise, do you want to start?
Yes. Tai, I just wanted to ask you about, as the founding director of UVic's Indigenous Governance Program, if you could tell us something about the challenges in beginning the program and how it has evolved over the last few years. Mm. And so the second part of the question, I wanted perhaps that you could talk a bit about the Indigenous Leadership Program and the principles of Indigenous political culture, and particularly your notion, and I quote you, of reaching into the depths of tradition to begin to build a future.
All right, well, good place to start. First of all, thanks for having me. It's great to be here. The program that we have now, which is a master's program and a PhD program, evolved out of a program that was established before I came to UVic. It was called the Administration of Aboriginal Governments Program. So that pretty much sums up what it was all about. It was a good title. It was about administration, it was about band management, it was about kind of being a bureaucrat within the system and serving Indigenous communities that way. The whole idea of how do we serve Indigenous communities, the university took the position at that time, the training people to serve the role of manager of the Indian Affairs system was the best way to go. I looked at it differently, of course, having come from that background in terms of my life and my work, and knew that we needed something different. And as soon as I got here, I taught in that program for a couple of years, and then once I became established here at the university, started to make the move within our administration, within our faculty, with the dean, with other faculty members who were supportive of Indigenous peoples, to reframe what it is that the university can do to support Indigenous peoples. And I guess to answer your first question, the biggest challenge was getting people to see that supporting Indigenous peoples wasn't necessarily supporting First Nations government. You know, the whole idea that the system that's been created to administer Indian reserves and to govern Native peoples is corrupt, and beyond that, illegitimate, and an instrument of colonialism as opposed to an instrument of Native peoples' liberation. That was the biggest challenge. So to get people to see that, and not only non-Native people, but our own people as well, to see the system for what it was, and then once you see the system for what it is, it's real easy to turn away from it and to try to put your mind in a way where you're thinking about an alternative. Now, once you understand the Indian Affairs system and band governments and the Assembly of First Nations and the Department of Indian Affairs in a true sense, you can't support them. I mean, if you have any commitment to justice or any commitment to principles other than capitalism and colonialism, you have to turn away and you have to start envisioning alternatives. And so we did have a core group of people at this university, faculty, students, and administrators, who were supportive of the need to design something to serve the Indigenous peoples as opposed to the First Nations government. And it started from there. And once the first hurdle was overcome, there was a lot of momentum behind what we're doing, because we immediately gained the support of groups within the community that had been up until this point isolated or marginalized. The system as it is deals with elites, and it deals with cultivated elites. I would be a prime example or target of that. myself. And so I think that something that made it easy at first was that they assumed I was one. So they assumed that having a PhD from Cornell, being a professor, all these sorts of things, that of course I was advancing the colonial agenda. So that would, that, in answer to your question again, made it quite easy for me to kind of get to a certain point, but then once they realize what your true agenda is, then you have to have a backup plan, you know. And my backup plan was laying it down on the table, saying this: these are the needs of the indigenous youth, the women, the true governments, the majority and the mass of people in Native communities. These are the needs that we have to meet. These people here, who you up until this point thought were representing indigenous people, are in fact employees of the colonial government. And I could prove that, and I could argue it, and it was irrefutable, especially when we had youth and women and elders sitting there with me saying these things. And so it created a momentum on the university campus, a momentum among a small group of people, I should say. And it gradually expanded with the help of yourselves and Jim Tully and other people on the campus, and you know, dozens of other people. Yeah. You know.
And so they sort of forgot, though, that you're from the Six Nations, the Iroquois Confederacy. Mm-hmm. So I wonder, could you just talk briefly, just for the sake of C Theory readers, about your background? Like, how does a Six Nations guy from the Iroquois Confederacy get out on the West Coast? And what are the implications when the Confederacy meets the West Coast?
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. It's interesting to think about. Well, first of all, I should say I'm from Ganawage, which is a community outside of Montreal that maybe some of your readers and your viewers will remember from 1990 and the whole crisis, so-called, around conflict between Mohawk Nation and Quebec in Canada in 1990.
The Oka Crisis.
We've written about it,
yeah.
And you've done stories on it and so forth. So there's a general awareness of that. That's where I'm from. I grew up there, and I was working there at Concordia, as you were at the time. And I always took seriously, within the Iroquois culture, the responsibility to promote the philosophy. And in our way of thinking, the Gayan Eragoa, which is the good way of being, it's oftentimes mistranslated as the great law of peace. But Gayan Eragoa just means the good way. And it's a whole worldview, and it's a philosophy of relationship. And it's codified in written and spoken form into a set of principles. And a really important principle in that philosophy is the idea of the great white roots of peace spreading in all four directions. So our people believe that we touched upon some knowledge and some wisdom about relationships that created peace and created harmony and justice. And it's our responsibility now to share that with the rest of the world. And it's very strongly promoted by the elders to those people that have the ability to speak and to write and so forth. And so around the time that I was a younger professor, people were starting to say, well, that's your responsibility, that's what you do. You know, if it was 300 years ago, you'd be one of those ambassadors that travel around and talk about the great peace and all that stuff, and I thought that was kind of cool. Too bad it's not that way anymore, but you know, now I have to get on a plane, go to Winnipeg, get on a plane, go to Toronto, talk about these sorts of things. But so that was always in my mind about the responsibility that I have as a Haudenosaunee person. And then the opportunity comes to travel around to do these things. I'm sort of open to that. The actual reason that I came out here had a lot to do with, on a personal level, of course, my situation. My wife is a native from British Columbia, and I had met her there in Montreal, and she moved over here to go to medical school. And so I had a personal motivation, although I didn't come right away. I had a personal motivation to want to come. But kind of blending together with that, she made it very clear that, you know, being a young person, she was young, a young person, she was very dissatisfied and alienated from the native politics out here, and she saw it as terrible what was happening, namely the BC treaty process and the surrender of all of the land title here and the whole bureaucratization of their nation. You know, it had been two generations only in her family from the time that they were living free and clear in their territory, you know, with no non-native interference at all. Her grandmother was, you know, living out in the bush, as they say, and was the first generation to come into town. And the family suffered greatly in the space of two generations. And so she carries that with her, and her whole family does. And they don't have the experience that our people do, 400 years of dealing with this issue. And so in her mind, I guess she was impressed with the attitude and the knowledge of the Iroquois people in dealing with colonialism. And so in her very non-political way, she would just say, you gotta come out here and talk some sense into our leaders. And on the Mohawk side, people saying there's a treaty process there, it's a sellout. The Nishka people are ready to surrender. They're gonna surrender. Go out there and don't let anybody else do it. You know, so it's kind of a situation where the personal and the political came together. And so the job here at University of Victoria was open to me because I had taught as a sessional here, and then they wanted me to come work here. Although I didn't end up coming to Victoria first, I actually had a job offer at UBC Law and turned that one down and came here.
Well, I'm glad you were at UV.
Me too.
So, Rudy, do you want to?
No, I just thought, well, probably to go along with Taiki's talking about, maybe you could talk about your notion of re-traditionalization, because I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, thanks. It's something that, you know, I reflected back on and kind of came up with the terminology for a process and a way of thinking that's very common in our community and is actually an ongoing facet of everyone's life. And so I don't see myself as inventing a concept or anything. I've named it in sort of academic terms, just the way that Mohawk people have regenerated themselves. And what I mean by that retraditionalization is, well, it's a terminology that's kind of used in anthropology and ethnography a lot, mm-hmm. but the way that I use it in my book, retraditionalization, in the new book, regeneration, there's an actual concept that came from a scholar in the 50s and 60s who wrote about Iroquois people called self-conscious traditionalism. And I kind of like that because it kind of touches on the psychological process or as a psychological process, and that's really what it is. If I think back about the history, the modern history of our people in Gunawage and in the Six Nations, it's very much a self-conscious reflection on tradition. And so it's not this unbroken inheritance, you know, this kind of romantic notion
right.
that you get in the movies and even in some writing of Native peoples, you know, struggling to survive, holding on to the language and the culture. And I don't know anyone like that, to tell you the truth. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can go to Cree country, maybe up north among the Dene and so forth. There's still some people live that way. But even there, people have reattached, I think, is more common, I should say. You know, among those people who consider themselves to be indigenous now in the way they live and they think, they've had to go through Christianity. They've had to go through colonial culture on the reserve, all the negativity around that, and the assimilative pressures to just conform. So it hasn't been this unbroken romantic notion of somebody fending off modernity. That doesn't exist. It's more, I mean, that was the grandmother and the grandfather. Today, it's more this idea of someone finding something very, very meaningful and authentic in their grandmother's way of thinking and being, and finding a way to take that and make that part of their life too. But there's a separation there. It's not unbroken. So this re-traditionalization and regeneration and this kind of self-conscious intellectual and psychological process of reflecting on who you are and who you want to be, and who you were, so to speak, in the past, that's ongoing every minute of the day. So it makes for a very kind of interesting life inside your head as an indigenous person, because you're constantly having to evaluate who you are. And I just wanted to make that clear in the writing, because a lot of people still have this idea of natives kind of with this unbroken heritage. And to tell you, I mean, to be honest, I mean, it's promoted and that romanticization is promoted by Native artists and writers
mm-hmm.
and in Native rhetoric a lot. But everybody who's Native knows it's not true.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to focus on that element. Yeah.
So how does this broken narrative get reflected in your political perspectives? And let me just frame that. Because what I notice in your writings, you move from Heeding the Air, really great books, right? Heeding the Voices of Our Ancestors, mm-hmm. book on Akwe. And then you move to Peace, Power, and Righteousness, which is really a recovery, mm-hmm. an eloquent mm-hmm. recovery of Mohawk ethics, mm-hmm. ethics of the seventh generation, to Wasasi, where Wasasi said, well, it's a remarkable change of tonality. Mm-hmm. And in fact, you are not leaving behind traditions, but in fact, what you foreground much more is really a self-conscious notion of warrior culture.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, a warrior culture was surprisingly based upon anarcho-indigenism.
Mm-hmm.
Thought, well, it's pretty interesting about what Hakam-based temporary autonomous zones. Mm-hmm. By the time I finished reading Wasasi, I said, well, hey, ties really come over to the side of temporary autonomous zones. Because you even attack, you know, you criticize the sacred notions of, well, land and territory. You begin to problematize them in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
So would you say that your thought at this point with Wasasi, with warrior culture, is undergoing like a real transformation in another direction, like a deepening at least?
Yeah, I think that's one way of looking at it, given that the two previous directions were, I believe, necessary, but in the end they were dead ends,
yeah.
as far as taking our people into the future.
Yeah.
You know, there's something that everyone kind of has to go through, put it that way.
Yeah, but how were they dead ends?
Well, even looking at the titles, because I put a lot of thought into the titles of my books, like you did. And Heeding the Voices of Our Ancestors is a direct quote from a Mohawk emissary to the French, not king, governor at the time, in a period of war.
Yeah.
And there's great rhetoric, it's quoted right at the front of the book, about the responsibility. He's kind of talking about his responsibility and who is the person that, you know, we're here to heed the voices of our ancestors and to carry forward in this struggle,
yeah.
to have you recognize who we are and respect who we are and so forth. So I keyed on that because that's what we were doing at the time, you know, so that was 250 years before,
yeah.
but at the time, and this is in the 1980s
yeah.
when I wrote that, we were doing the same sort of thing. We were engaging with the colonial power and fighting in various ways to have them recognize us and respect us. And the way, the vehicle for that was through nationhood. So they had nations. We had nations because we were co-equal people. That was the logic, right? So if you're a nation, we're a nation too. And there's a whole literature and a whole political philosophy built up around that. And to tell you the truth, it's still the one that is the foundation of Native politics right now,
yeah.
on the national and domestic and international level. It's about nationhood. And I worked in that for many years, and our nation was, our people and our nation was constructed around that struggle for respect and recognition and equality on a nation level. What we found though, what I found, and what more and more people are coming to the conclusion towards now, is that the idea of a nation is constructed in a larger political and philosophical environment, and it demands of people as collectives and as individuals certain concessions to Western ways of thinking and worldviews and so forth. To think of yourself as having the ability to distinguish and separate the people from the government, an apparatus of government as opposed to a direct form of government. People who are listening to this will be familiar with all the criticisms I'm laying out here, right? So I don't need to go through all the details.
But
it's statehood, basically.
Yeah. But this is like at the end of Wasasi, when you agree with Gandhi, you said, really, what do you have? What Indian and Mohawk philosophies, Wasasi, have in common?
Yeah.
Is in fact, it's an anti-statist interpretation.
Yeah.
So this builds on this.
Yeah, and so we started off as statists, really.
Yeah.
You know, and I remember talking about this in many different forms. People saying, you know, are you looking for a state? And of course, this is in Quebec in the 80s and 90s, and people are, well, are you looking for a state too? You know, that kind of thing. And well, I have the right to, and yes, in the future, maybe we will. I remember saying that, not realizing that the state will, being in a statist agenda, will reshape us from being who we are as Indigenous people. And that's the second book, really, you know. So you come to that realization, and then you're like, well, our whole political project now is I mean, there's some nobility in it, in the struggle, but at the same time, I can't really support it given what I know now. And so I had to reformulate an agenda. And so the next title for the book is an English translation, again, of another phrase from the culture. Not a quote this time, but actually three powerful principles within the Gayana Rigoa, the Great Law. And that really speaks to what I was trying to do at that time, which is to say, you know, it's not enough to have statehood or an apparatus of government, whether it's a First Nation or something like that, but the content of it and the character of it makes a difference. And what we need to do is to revitalize and restore our traditional forms of government. And so that phrase there, traditional form of government, is everywhere in Native politics as well. And for a long time, it was the antithesis of Aboriginal government, of self-government. So there was self-government and traditional government. And in Native politics, those two words kind of play off each other, and they still do. Problem is, for me, is that getting involved in the traditional philosophy more, understanding it deeper, coming to appreciate what traditional governance was in terms of the forms, the processes, the ideas, the people, I came to admire them even more for how strongly they defended the concept of our nationhood and of our traditional governments and so forth. But I also, on the other hand, came to the realization that this form of government and these institutions and these processes, they're not capable of governing us today. And the people, they're not capable of governing us today. They don't have the skill, they don't have the ability to engage with those forces that are threatening us in very powerful ways. And so it was kind of a heartbreaking moment, you know, potentially demoralizing to say, well, our tradition is not capable of taking us into the future. It's somewhat of a insulated kind of a throwback to the past. I wouldn't come out and sort of label it that way, because it might be too harsh a judgment, but intellectually, that's kind of what you feel like, you know? You kind of feel like, well, this, I can see where this is headed, and it's not really gonna help the people in the long run. And so, the next step, you kind of reach the next step.
This leads to your three rejections, really, your refusals, traditionalism, nationalism, and aboriginalism.
Yeah, the aboriginalism part comes in, I wrote about it in this new book, because I think what this notion of aboriginalism that I call is actually the attempt to maintain the course, to stay on those roads, and stay on those roads for its own sake, to say that we were right with our nationalist agenda, and tradition is the way, and Native languages, Native identities, and nationhood and so forth is the thing that we need to protect and preserve, and we need to build our future on that without considering the political implications of that, of the actual basic need. And the basic need is for the people to survive as Natives, not for the people to survive, period, because our ancestors never said that. You know, they didn't say preserve yourselves by selling out to the white man, save yourselves by giving up your language and culture and having enough to eat. They never said that. They said, go to war intellectually, spiritually, and physically, make friends, do diplomacy, teach people, do whatever you need to do to survive as a Ongwehungwe, and in friendship and with respect to the other person. That's what they said. Now these two other paths, they're taking us towards the surrender of who we are and a subsuming of a true indigenous person into this broader notion of aboriginal, which is basically just an ethnic category in the larger economic, cultural, and political environment of Canada. So I've labeled it aboriginalism. It's a surrender. And so to me, that was a betrayal, and a conscious betrayal by a small number of people, but a subconscious or an unconscious betrayal by a large number of people. And so what do you do at that time if you consider yourself to be in the forefront? And I was reflecting back on this responsibility that I talked about.
Yeah.
The responsibility is to wake the people up. And so then I go and I look in our tradition again, and not so much go look, but just try to remember, you know, what is it in our own tradition, in the language and the ceremonies and that I know and that I keep hearing that talks about this responsibility. And a lot of people focus on ceremony for ceremony's sake, and they kind of have a religious view. And I'm very different than that, for those that know me. I don't take a religious view of our ceremony. They're spiritually powerful, but they also teach us. And they're also very, very powerful teaching tools and ways of conveying knowledge in a real sense, in a pragmatic sense. And there are ceremonies and there are teachings within our culture that talk about the responsibility to challenge and to be the one to climb up on the tallest pine tree and to see the danger coming and to yell and to come down and to warn the people and to get them together, unified, and take them to a safe place and re-teach them what it is to be Ongwehunwe and to teach them the responsibility so that they can confront that danger. I mean, in English, I'm saying something that is spoken in the native languages within our great law. So our people have dealt with this many times before, right? But a lot of people in our culture today don't understand it in terms that you mentioned that is the focus of the book of a warrior. You know, they don't understand the responsibility to challenge everything for the sake of the principle. They defer to tradition, they defer to the idea of nation, they fear colonialism, and they're willing to accept a lot of things, a lot of compromises, just to be named a native, or just to be named First Nations, or just to be named Aboriginal. Whereas I think the responsibility in our culture is very, very clear. It's laid out in our culture. The truth is the important thing. And the truth about our existence is very different than the one that's being created. So that's where this Wasaze title comes from. It's a war dance. And it comes from the name of in the spiritual universe of the Haudenosaunee, the thunderers are the beings, the mythical beings that protect the people from the forces of chaos and disruption. And it's related to the springtime and the coming of the rains and the cleansing of the earth. And that's the theme that I've seized on for this latest book, because the thunderers are the mythical beings that stand in the way of chaos and destruction. And that's to me what a warrior is. And it means challenging everything. It means challenging the accepted notions of what traditionalism is. It means challenging the political agendas. And that's where I come into league with, like if you think of Gandhi as being the primary proponent and hero of this philosophy and way of approaching what resistance is. But even in like Edward Said, if you read his writing, you know, obviously he challenges tradition, he challenges accepted notions of history and of what it is to be a Palestinian. And he also is very strong in speaking against colonialism and imperialism. So I think this latest book kind of shifted from, it's kind of located at a, for me, what is a true place for indigenous person today. And it's not that the other two were consciously false or manipulative, it's just that we're finding out more and more about what it is to be in resistance as we go along. So the first book was written in the 80s, then the 90s, and now we got this one. And it's just been a while, and we've come to understand in a better and better way what's needed. And what's needed right now is what I'm talking about in this book, as opposed to the other agendas.
Yeah, and then how would it relate, though, to other warrior cultures? And because right across Canada is really armed confrontation, almost always defensive in nature, on the part of Indigenous resistance.
Yeah.
In New Brunswick, in Ontario for sure, in British Columbia. And, you know, that's been a hard form of resistance, but that's definitely warrior culture as well.
Oh, yeah.
And, but Wasaze, where you're talking about, it's really based on the principle of nonviolence. It comes closer to Gandhi in that case.
Yeah, that's a strategic calculation, I'd say.
Yeah.
So I've never been, myself, I've never been averse to violence and being involved in that environment.
And you were a Marine.
Yeah, I was a U.S. Marine, so I kind of understand the power and the attraction and the utility of violence to a certain extent, and also the limitations, of course, and the implications of it. So it was very helpful for me to have been in the Marine Corps. I don't think that I could have written this book if I hadn't been in the Marine Corps, because I would have been attracted to the idea of a revolutionary violence, I think. You know, because in the short term, it is effective. It can't be denied that in a very short term, using violence works. And it's very attractive to
for media attention.
Media attention and pushing someone away and causing them to be out of your space. Yeah, okay, you can use violence for that. But there's always the bounce back to it, which is one thing. There's always the effects on you of using violence. There's always the larger force that will come back to get you for using violence. So all of these things, you know, being in the Marine Corps and just observing and being taught and being aware as I was in the Marine Corps, but also, and I was in the infantry too, so like I wasn't a supply clerk or anything like that. I was actually on the ground as a Marine, right, with a gun. And
original
then,
violence, right?
Yeah. And then the experience in 1990 in Oka, in Ganawage. I was in Ganawage, I was in Oka. So seeing, you know, this played out from the other side reinforced ideas. And of course, I was older and more educated in 1990 than I was in 1982, 1983. Reinforced the idea that as much as a young man can be attracted to violence, we have to temper that with knowledge. Right. And I would be the first one to say, and I would say it, if violence had a hope in hell of working, I'd say let's do it, because again, the principle is survival of our existence as a people. And if it had a hope in hell of creating a situation where there was opportunity for good people in Canadian society to make a relationship with good people in the Indigenous society by pushing out bad people, those sorts of things. If I had that mentality, I wouldn't shy away from recommending it and from advocating it. But my knowledge from all of my experience and from looking at situations all over the world where revolutionary violence has been used to advance the notion of justice has told me that it fails every time. It may have succeeded in certain instances, but that was in a different global political environment where there were two blocks of countries. We're getting to strategy and politics now, but it's a very different environment that we live in today. And advocating the use of violence to promote a political objective for Indigenous peoples in North America especially is ridiculous. You know, it's suicide, number one, and it's the best way to alienate and to isolate a movement. And so not wanting to do that, or any of those things, I look at, well, what is the way? You know, and I put violence on the table. It's talked about in the book. It's there's political contention, there's cultural movement, and there's accommodation. And all these sort of strategies and tactics are, in my view, looked at for what they are and what the potentials are in each of them. And my conclusion in looking at them is that political contention is the strongest form of resistance that we can use today without going overboard into the point where we harm ourselves in using that tactic and bring harm upon ourselves and defeat our movement even before we get started. So that's why I favor political contention. And like Gandhi, I think, I mean, Gandhi was born into a religion and a culture, his particular religion and culture, which was nonviolent. The Jains are, it's founded on that principle. But I mean, he's quoted as saying too, as well, when you're thinking about the political movement, that it was a strategic consideration as well, to not engage the British Empire in violent ways. That in fact, ahimsa was the principle that was going to be the one to liberate them. It's a spiritual commitment on his part, but it also was a political and strategic logic to it. And the same thing I would say applies here.
So, would you think that Musasi then, in terms of, you know, its political philosophy, its political alliances, would be part of a much broader movement? I was thinking of Bolivia, the events that are happening today in Bolivia, Peru, mm-hmm. and Venezuela.
Yeah.
And in terms of indigenous resistance, particularly in Bolivia with Morales.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you think about what's going on right now with Evo Morales in Bolivia, you kind of see the principles playing themselves out. And that's not to say that my book is influential or anything, far from it. They didn't even know who I am. What it is saying is that the book reflects on an indigenous way of doing revolutions.
Yeah.
Okay, so the people in Mexico and in Chiapas and the Zapatistas, their revolutionary movement reflects these principles as well. The people who have organized the 80% of the population in Bolivia to fight first over water, then over gas, now over political control of the country.
Yeah. And the armed forces.
And the armed forces, and to go up against the United States in relation to coca production and so forth. They are organizing an indigenous population. It's going to be informed by indigenous cultural principles. And that's the same thing here. And it's, so it is the same movement, I would say. It's an indigenous people's rising. And it's reflecting, in the way that it's manifested politically, the political context. And so in Bolivia, it's taken a certain form, and in Mexico, it's taken a form. And here in North America, I mean, we're so fat and happy and deluded that the first struggle is actually waking people up, you know, waking them up. But no doubt, whenever you look at a conflict, burnt church, the Oka situation, now in Caledonia, in Six Nations, you begin to see similar principles being advocated by the ones who are taking the struggle forward, and you see similar reactions from the white population, from the comprador class in the native population, from governments and so forth. It's one of the themes in the book here, is that you can have a typology almost of indigenous resistance and state reactions. And you can lay it out, and whether you're in Ecuador, Bolivia, Mexico, or Canada, it follows a pattern, which to me is good in a certain way, because it shows that we're consistent with indigenous culture and doing what we're doing. And if we remain consistent to indigenous principles in advocating a struggle, I think that we're heeding those voices there. You know, we're doing the thing today that needs to be done. Because 50, 60, 70 years ago, they did it in a certain way. When Descaje went over to Geneva and advocated for a recognition of us as states in the League of Nations and was rebuffed.
Yeah.
That was the way they did it then, when Tecumseh tried to organize all the Indian nations to prevent the land expansion against the United States Empire, growing incipient empire. That's what he was doing too. So we're just following along and trying to do what we need to do in order to have our people survive. But as you said, it means today rethinking what territory is, and rethinking what community is, and rethinking what being indigenous is.
Yeah, well, because when I read Wasasi, you know, which really describes like predatory white settler cultures who aren't accidentally, they're just deliberately intent from a state point of view on exterminism of indigenous peoples, because indigenous peoples are an inconvenient fact. They separate the state from control, and corporations from control of natural resources and the forest and the land through the country itself. So when I was reading that, I thought, well, raised in terms of alliances, I guess two questions. One, I mean, you have like whiteness, it's like it appears in your writings, this kind of monolithic category. And this is special pleading on my part, of course. But I said, well, whiteness, like in, you know, theoretical terms, has really been problematized. There's debates going on everywhere in the world saying this. That, like everything else, has been purloined in some ways.
Yeah.
The borders have been crossed.
Yeah.
And the construction of whiteness is also based on questions of race, class, and gender, and things like this. And as Mary Louise would know about Canadian culture, with multiculturalism and heavy immigration to the country, the tone of the country is basically a brown country, actually.
Mm-hmm.
You know, go to like cities like Toronto or other things. You know, things have changed.
Although I'm sure Tayaki, what he'd say about that is, I'll just add that, is that the state is still very white, even though, you know, places like Toronto become very multicultural.
Yeah. But isn't it possible, though, that just in terms of an analysis of our political situation, that in fact there's real possibilities for delegitimating the population from its state?
Mm-hmm.
And the state has its elites that are running the state. I don't feel any particular affiliation with that. A lot of people I don't.
Yeah.
Like in the United States, I have no affiliation with the Bush regime and stuff like this.
Mm-hmm.
And they're, you know, definitely don't have any kind of political moorings.
Yeah.
You know, but it would just strike me that the political situation today is really, really fluid, actually.
Yeah.
So I finished reading Los Hossi and I was immensely optimistic.
Yeah.
I thought, well, how can I be optimistic in this situation of absolute extremism, genocidal empires at work? And I thought, well, I was optimistic because I thought, well, Los Hossi and indigenous philosophy is equal to the survival of everyone. If we don't, there's no way white settler cultures are going to survive in the long term.
Mm-hmm.
We just think 250 years ahead.
Mm-hmm.
This white settler culture is dust,
mm-hmm.
actually. And, you know, the indices are all around us.
Yeah.
Nature itself is rebuilding and things.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, the Taiyaki is, and other, you know, political philosophers of Los Hossi are charting out is in fact a strategy for not just indigenous survival but human survival. It's
mm-hmm.
based on different moral and ethical principles.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great way of stating it. And one of the things that we challenge, I guess the main challenge for our students who are non-indigenous, who are descended from Englishmen and Ukrainian women and Scots and Irish who come to Canada and then come in our program and get involved in our movement, the main challenge to them is to envision an identity, to develop an identity, envision a national identity that's delinked from colonialism. And to, I don't have a terminology for it yet, so I think that's the job of the people who will be doing that. And so in our political movement, it's a very active part of what we're encouraging them to do, aside from political action and so forth, is this kind of the same thing, the self-conscious, not traditionalism, but the self-conscious aspect of inventing a non-indigenous identity set out of settler culture that is something that reflects the principles that we're talking about here, you know, the respect, the sharing, and so forth. But I still use the term white because it's still, it's not monolithic, but it's still strong enough to represent like a major force.
Yeah.
And I always reflect back on a funny line that I remember and has always stuck with me from, I don't know if people know Chief Dan George.
Mm-hmm.
But you remember in Little Big Man?
Yes.
When he says, they ask him if he ever saw an African American. And he goes, He goes, I remember seeing that. He goes, yes, 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 I've seen one before. The black white man. It's true. I mean, you could have the black white man, the yellow white man, the white man, and the red white man. That's the way I'm using white. It's like the colonial mentality and the construction of a superiority of being that's so reflective out of empire. And so white, I don't know, I wouldn't call you white. I'd have to think of a different terminology.
Lumpen proletariat. Besides even reading the term settler culture, I thought, well, okay, my family came from, who knows where they came from. Family with no genealogy, no tradition, dumped in barren lands of Manitoba, sandy lands, and told to make a living farming. My dad grew up with a family of 16 kids, starving to death, actually, and struggled their way to the cities and stuff. So I thought, well, not successful settlers, that's for sure.
I think
an accidental population.
So. I think white at this point has to be has to have a qualifier to it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's poor white, and there's elite, and so forth. And, you know, but I'm serious when I'm saying, like, there can be native white men.
Yeah, I know.
There are. I mean, majority of Native people today are white-minded.
Yeah.
And that's more of like what you talk about, more of a European kind of tradition. European kind of tradition. Because now what I think is wonderful about Canada, and I hope we can go to the next level, is the fact that it's not, the immigrants that are coming are not European-based for the most part. They're from all over the world. And my only concern is that when people now sort of compartmentalize their lives and send their children to especially religious schools, and so instead of being part of a larger culture, which I think would be conducive to a better Canadian state, which I hope will in fact happen, that in fact they're sort of having this ghettoization, particularly in places like Montreal and Toronto and also in Vancouver.
Well, you notice in the sections that are the sort of intellectual, the logical, the argumentative sections, I use Euro-American or European. to be precise, whereas in the more rhetorical
section... And it's not used as a term of praise.
No, not at all. although I have some background myself, of course, and from that culture and that place. But in the sections that are more rhetorical and polemical, I use white, because there's nothing harder than to be East Indian or Pakistani or Chinese or Latin American and to be called white, right? Because you reflect a whiteness that's hard to hear. And I'm saying it on purpose, because Ujjal Dosanjh is white. The MPs of the Conservative Party who are advocating the genocide of our people after escaping genocide in Asia, there's nothing more white than that. And before them, the Irish were made white. They weren't white before they were colonized, then they became white. So this whole discourse of whiteness is real interesting to me, because it is. It's a false notion biologically. You know, the Russians weren't white before, 50 years ago or something like that. And it's this kind of process of taking people into empire and making them not only imperial subjects, but components and then proponents of the empire that creates whiteness. So in my mind, anybody can be white, and it's anybody can be indigenous. It's a matter of the worldview that you act on. And so I wanted to sort of rhetorically poke at people and say, think about what you're saying and what you're doing, and not just the skin color, because to me that's the height of racism, is to say just because I have a DNA from a certain part of the world that I for all time have the rights and so forth associated with, and the cultural rights to be labeled as someone, when no. In our way of looking at it, it's the way you think and the way you behave. It's your actions that determine who you are, not blood quantum or anything like that. And so it's kind of a engagement with that whole multicultural.
That's what I like about when you talk about the fact that you're not into purity at all. I think that's wonderful.
My grandmother was white. She didn't see herself as white. She saw herself as English, as white people tend to do. They see themselves as where they come from, right?
Yeah.
They don't think of themselves as white. She didn't really. I mean, she was from Tunbridge Wells in Kent in England, and she thought of herself as English. And then she thought of herself as Mohawk, because culturally and legally and politically she had become assimilated. So it was real interesting to talk to her, because she would on one hand be English and on the other hand she would be Mohawk. And of course everybody in the family had different views on her in terms of being either English or not, or being Mohawk or not. You know, she was her, first of all, as a person. But then, you know, political identity and status and race, very interesting discussion there. So I could never be a person to be simplistic about racial identity, number one, and then kind of a political identity based on race. I couldn't accept something so simplistic as white versus native.
Definitely.
So Wasasi is a form of indigenous resistance that really does cross boundaries all the time.
I hope so.
Because you're involved with this. Studying really the social construction of whiteness, and it was really an eloquent description on your part. You cross boundaries with a state, like an anti-statist interpretation. You find common cause with, I was really surprised when I saw you describing yourself as Wasasi as anarcho-indigenous.
An interesting terminology.
Yes, and then later in the book, when you come back and you say, well, really, you need to really rethink the notions of land and territory, because we're not talking things fixed, in a much more fluid sense of territory and land itself. Do you want to speak about the anarchist roots of indigenous resistance?
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, there's some people have been writing on it for a little while. The one that comes to mind in Canada is Richard Day, from Queens in sociology. You know, he's been writing about the intersection, or maybe not the intersection, but the points of connection between indigenous political philosophies and anarchist philosophies. And he's identified myself and a couple of other people in articulating an indigenous philosophy. And then he's kind of linked those to some thought patterns in the writings of certain other philosophers. So he's been doing that for a while. And I really like his work, and I mean him as a person. He's a great person to be kind of engaging us on this. But I do want to make clear that the first usage of the word anarcho-indigenism in print is in Wasaze. So anybody who's going to use it, you got to cite my book on that. Basically, that's why I use the word in the book. I didn't really, in case you didn't notice, I didn't develop the concept of the book.
So, that's waiting to be developed. What about the notion of temporary autonomous zones?
No, the whole idea of anarcho-indigenism.
But the reason I'm asking is this, because there's a contradiction in the book.
Okay.
Okay, and a contradiction, and maybe in your perspective, mm-hmm. and it's maybe one of these, you know, when you quote the Chinese hexagram, mm-hmm. and you say, well, you know, there were real contradictions between your subjectivity and mm-hmm. objectives. And I thought, well, this is a being a good thought.
To me, that's a mark of genius.
Yeah, well, it's good. Then.
Okay. There's contradictions in your thought.
Yeah, no, I said, I absolutely agree with this. Very consistent argument. But because the book so much is based on like a notion of like the recovery of Unkwe Hanwe for the original people, but also a very original conception of relationships between indigenous peoples and the land,
mm-hmm.
Hard circumstances mm-hmm. and things like this. And at the same time, you say in the book, well, it's no use going back to like a form of nativism that only speaks romantically about land, because mm-hmm. in fact everyone's living, many people are living within the cities, and there's no immediate connection to land anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I found it very interesting that at the end of the text, then you suddenly, you know, it's anarcho-indigenism, and you're speaking about temporary autonomous zones. Mm-hmm. I thought, well, here's a conception of land, which is really different, I think, than most indigenous philosophy that I've read.
Mm.
It's certainly different than Lang's kind of treaty, the basis of British Columbia politics.
Yeah. Well, I guess the main difference is I don't really see it as a contradiction, more as a reflection of the complexity of the reality that we're facing. I think in the long term, like if you take a long term view and you sort of try to project into the future where this might all play out, you know, if you look at population demographic trends and the breakdown of this, the colonial society and rearrangement of political authority and so forth, you could envision at some point there being a population base and a capacity for a temporary autonomous zone or more even like a Zapatista concept of an autonomous indigenous zone. And it's articulated by one of the people that I interviewed in the book, James Ward, who really looks at that as an ideal. For myself, that's like a long-term kind of theoretical projection. In reality, what I'm talking about is even in the context of a city, of an urban environment, you cannot be indigenous. I would say you can't be fully human. You can't maintain a humanity without a connection to the land. But where it differs from the idea of territory as it's operationalized today, is it's not looked at land. Land is not looked at as territory to be exploited for commercial purposes or for capitalistic purposes. So land is not real estate. Land is an inheritance and a necessary element of our spiritual and physical being. And the connection to that is not one of building a fence, having a border, having a house, and controlling that land. It's interaction with the land. And so the necessity there is the imperative then is quite different than the commercial imperative. So right now, what's guiding indigenous politics is the conception of land that is very much in harmony with the idea of real estate and resource development and so forth. So natives don't live on the land for the most part. They live on reserves. And they parcel out the land for resource extraction, just the same way as anyone else does. What I'm saying is what we need to do is reverse that. We need to get people off the reserve, interacting with the land, but not necessarily in a way that delineates territory in the same way as the mainstream society does. Okay, what we want to do is have an interaction with the land to draw the sources of sustenance that we need physically, in terms of being able to gain physical sustenance, food from the land, but also spiritually in terms of the power that exists there to nurture humans, whether you look at it psychologically or spiritually or otherwise, and also to do the kind of things on the land that create community. I don't really believe in community in the cities myself that's a point of discussion for anybody, and that's a big one for a lot of people. But indigenous communities don't exist in the cities. No matter what the rhetoric of friendship centers and organizations are, there are lots of indigenous people in the city. There are a lot of indigenous people trying to survive culturally in the city, but there is no indigenous community because they are separated from the sources of their existence as indigenous people. In every culture and every language, there's this seamless interaction with the land. And just to understand the language, just to understand the culture, you have to have that. And not to say you're completely non-indigenous or you're completely alienated if you live in the city, of course not. But in order to fully grasp it, in order to continue to develop as a person, there has to be that. So when I talk about land, it's as this kind of site of existence and a site of interaction, as opposed to a delineation of a piece of land to be exploited somehow. And even in the way that it's represented in court cases, in as in quotes traditional views, it's still a resource. You know, so they say this chief owned this land, and therefore that chief and his descendants have the right to be compensated when forest companies cut down the trees. Or they have the right for all of the resources that exist. That's real simplistic kind of corruption of what our ancestors understood the land to be. Of course it involved getting food from, but as I tried to explain, now that's just one element. There's a whole set of other interactions with the land that are essential to being indigenous. And that's something that you don't understand really until you really immerse yourself into an indigenous worldview, an indigenous culture. And that's not here in North America only, everywhere. So the Zapatistas understand that, the Bolivian people understand that, people in India understand that, people all over the place understand. People in Ireland and Scotland and Russia and Poland knew that too. But because of the way that cultures have been transformed because of empire and commercial empires, we've all been separated from that, and society as a whole pays the price. So it's very much an advocacy for every human to look at land in a different way. But we're, being indigenous people in North America and in South America and Central America, we're still so close to the land that we can appreciate it, I think, a lot more than people who have been separated for generations and generations. And I don't think farmers operating in an industrial food production environment count as people being close to the land. It's different what I'm talking about here.
And so would you see land then, this notion of land, as being the basis for reunion? Because in Wasasi, you write about the reunification of communities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was trying to think through the political principles and anti-statist interpretation, politics of regeneration, land, you know, there's a really spiritual sense on land, but also the notion of reunification of indigenous communities, really.
Well, I think it's certainly the case.
I'm surprised with this, and we should talk about this, about how you can have communities within cities. No, because I just say this from a totally alienated urban perspective.
Well, so indigenous communities, for sure. Yeah. I mean, I don't know about sustaining.
But you don't think that's possible?
Well, I don't know. You said that this culture's on its way out anyway, so I've been talking about sustaining a community for thousands of years in a nation, you know?
Yeah.
Whenever the land has been, whenever people have been dispossessed or whenever the land has been mistreated, the empire has fallen. And so, to me, that says the land and the people have to be in a respectful relationship.
Yeah.
And so, to me, urban culture today is part of that unharmonious, disrespectful relationship. Not to say everything about it is bad. There's great things that come out of urban culture. But it is, for the long term, as you said, kind of part of the 250-year projection into oblivion or dust.
Yeah.
And people in the city have to find a way to connect to a place, the land, or else we're all going to be part of that process. That's my own personal view.
That's good.
It's certainly true for indigenous peoples where it's explicit in the culture in terms of the worldview, the way you interact with people, and the languages being rooted in an experiential relationship to land and a healthy environment. It's essential for them to have some sort of land. And that's the context, the more present context that my remark comes out of, because for urban native communities, like the one I live in, there is an imperative for those people to develop a means, culturally, physically, and otherwise, to gain what they need from the land and to commit themselves to the preservation of that. And that's what I'm saying here. So I'm not saying everybody has to go live on the land. That's maybe the contradiction that you see. I'm not saying everybody has to go give up their house and go live on the land. In fact, that's impractical. But what we have to do is develop.
But I was referring back to your comment in your analysis in Wasasa, where you say, no, in fact, this connection to the land has been lost. And this makes sense in terms of your comments.
Yeah.
And they can't simply assume they have like an automatic connection to land, because you're saying it's something.
I mean, the generation of young Native people today basically have none. That's why it's such a crisis, and there's such an urgency to what I'm saying, is that the young Native person today, one out of, I don't know, 50, something like that, will have a sense of how important the land is to the existence of the people, and will have in a personal sense a connection. Even if they live out on a reserve way up north, television and mainstream culture have basically severed indigenous people from their connection to the land.
Yeah, and that's one of the questions.
Yeah, because that's actually the question I wanted to ask was about globalization, which in many ways is, you know, as far as the cultural industries is concerned, is Americanization, and how that would affect young indigenous people, because in fact with videos and the net and music, youth culture in general, that a lot of indigenous people, probably young people, as a lot of young people all over the world, would have more affinity with other youth cultures than maybe with their own.
That's totally true.
Yeah.
It's totally true. There's, I kind of make my forays into it because I have a website too, and I kind of work with youth groups and younger people. And I mean, there's no way I'm going to be able to communicate on an authentic level with a 17-year-old or anything like that on these issues. But I kind of watch and try to get a sense from my own relatives and from our students as to what's going on. And from watching and looking at all the youth publications and listening to young people when they talk about these sorts of things in informal and formal ways, it doesn't seem like the sense of identity, the political identity as a Native, has been harmed. In fact, in anything, it's been heightened, because they've managed to connect with other Native peoples, and there's kind of solidarity, and you know, so you have this indigenous identity arising out of it, and they're all supporting each other, and they're all kind of egging each other on, you know, and there's a lot of strength to the rhetoric, and there's a lot of strength to the kind of posturing. So as a political identity, it's there, but think about it, while they're on the computer for 6 hours a night, MSNing each other and on MySpace and so forth, talking about how indigenous they are, they're not doing hunting, they're not ceremonies, they're not doing this, they're not doing that, they're not even meeting real other indigenous people, they're on a computer. So it's kind of a paradox. The political identity has been strengthened greatly, and the connections are great. You know, they're networked all over the place, all over the world as indigenous people. But the actual putting it into practice, it's difficult. Look at Six Nations now, and the dispute that's going on there over the land, and the attempt by some people to defend a piece of land that was unfairly ceded by the Department of Indian Affairs and been in contention for years and years, and now people finally taking a stand. Now, there's a few people there, but there's a lot of people expressing rhetorical support, but not a lot of people physically there, and there's still a lot of dissension in the community as to whether or not that's a right thing to do or a wrong thing to do. So it's not a situation where there's this massive sort of latent force of Native people who are all connected, ready to jump on and move forward. In fact, it's kind of this intangible sense of what it is to be indigenous, and there's all these connections, but it doesn't have any organization, it doesn't have any meaning, it doesn't really touch down anywhere.
So it's more about, do you think it's more of a cultural kind of indigenous kind of feeling than the political? Has it been separated?
It has been, and consciously so. And I'm very critical in the book, but not so much as in my own speaking, and interactions of artists and writers and teachers and professors who are Native, for separating cultural resistance from political resistance. And Vine Deloria Jr., who is a longtime writer and standout thinker among Native peoples for years, was harshly critical of this towards the end of his life. He died last year. And he was critical of Native intellectuals for talking about cultural resistance and music and art and film and so forth, and being caught up in the globalized economy and accepting a status as a token, as opposed to advancing political resurgence and regeneration through their art. And people, of course, were hurt by this and so forth, but it's true. I've said the same thing many times, and most of the people who are involved in indigenous resistance on the ground are very critical of writers and artists and professors who talk about it in cultural terms as if that's enough.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I'm sure you both agree with me. I mean, it's writing, music, all these sorts of things are absolutely essential, but not in and of themselves. They're not enough. You know, they have to be paired with a political struggle, and I believe a political agenda and a political association that means something in the political environment, meaning it has some force and it can make a difference. Otherwise, it's just part of the global trade.
Right.
You know, people love t-shirts that say the indigenous strike back, and they love hats that say red power and all that stuff. Great, but unless they're attached to an actual movement, they're just commercialism.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, a lot of the rap, a lot of the more rhetorical forms, whether it's in print or on record, are just that. They're just posturing. And so the challenge to the youth is to put their principles into practice. And I'm not criticizing the youth here. I'm just saying we haven't organized
right.
to the extent that they have the opportunity to do that. There's the Native Youth Movement here in British Columbia. There's the West Coast Warrior Society. There's warrior societies in some of the Iroquois communities. There's the Gidjida Warrior Society in Manitoba. East Coast Warrior Society. But guess what? Almost every one of those groups is affiliated with us and our little clique of people. You know, it's like an extended network of our friends and our associates. And it's not to dismiss it as nothing, but you know, we haven't put the work into having a broad-based association of people and an organization of people that's an infrastructure for resistance in a political and economic sense. And our youth now are caught up in this kind of rhetorical form of being indigenous because we don't have an association for them to channel. If they want to channel their energy into politics, it either goes through some co-opted, moderate government organization like the Assembly of First Nations, Métis Federation, Native Women's Association. These are all bought and paid for by the government of Canada. And young people now, because they're so intelligent and educated and aware because of their connections, they know that that's a sellout. So where do they go? Those that are really, really hardcore come to the youth movement, the Warrior Society, and so forth. But what about those who want some channel for their energy that are not willing to go, you know, stand out on a blockade all the time and give up every semblance of a normal life in order to advance an agenda? I think every other successful movement had an association or an organization for those types of energies. And that's really what we're lacking right now. Every form of organization in Native community is colonial up until this point.
So the meeting that's going to take place here, University of Victoria next month, Losasi, do you see this as the beginnings of a political movement?
Well, I do. It's come out of this exact frustration. You know, I mean, the next step for someone who is following on this path, whether it's myself kind of trying to think about it, people who have been doing this for a while, you know, where do we go, or our students kind of trying to learn and think of a position for themselves in the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years, is to go and to try to put this into practice. Like, not to say my book is the end-all and be-all of indigenous resistance, but it's a pretty comprehensive collection of ideas. I don't think I missed anything, to tell you the truth. I don't think anything's been missed, and I've been all over the country, in both Canada and the United States, talking about this. Talked to elders and AIM people and warriors and all kinds of people. No one said, oh, you missed this, or it's there. So anybody who picks up this book can see what's been done, what the latest thinking is, and presumably where we could be headed. Not where we should be, where we could be headed, because it's plural subtitle there. And now the challenge is not to write another book about indigenous resistance. It would be redundant now. It's, well, how do we do it? Let's do it, and let's learn from the doing it. So that's where this thing in June comes up. We're having a seminar. Well, I don't even want to call it a seminar because that's too kind of academic.
It's like a workshop.
We're calling it a summer institute where there'll be students, there'll be scholars, but there'll also be community people, native and non-native, coming together. The thing that draws them all together is that they've realized what we're talking about here. So they've all been involved in other movements, whether it's intellectual, political, or otherwise. And they're all frustrated with the fact that all of their energy gets channeled into supporting the state in the end, as opposed to advancing the notion of justice. And so what we're going to try to do is conceptualize what a new form of organization would be that can take us towards our notion of justice. And I've already kind of developed some principles in consultation with a small group of people. And the whole idea is to say, you know, here's something. We have been I've spent 15 years now. Other people have spent 5-10 years thinking about this, and this is the best we can come up with now. And so you, as a group of smart, younger people who are looking 40 years down the road and who are quite aware of what's going on in Native communities all over North America and non-Native people who know the reaction, what the reaction is going to be to this, let's think about it for 2 weeks and let's, in the end, come up with something solid that we can bring out to the rest of the country and say this is what we stand for and who wants to join us. So that's a really
significant moment.
Well, I hope it turns out to be something, because the way it's headed right now, we don't have a voice. You know, we're all individuals who are in a position of criticizing the official Aboriginal perspective. So I get a call every day from CBC or someone, and you know, the AFN says this, the government says this, what do you say? And I'm always kind of asked to respond to what the official Indian says. Well, we want to take that away from them because it's not their part to be saying that. So we want to start a movement so that at minimum the government appointed natives will be delegitimized as the representative voice. To me, that's important because it's like a liberal democratic principle that the government operates on. However it manipulates it behind the scenes, it's consent. And they've been very, very sophisticated in their strategy of making sure that Native consent will come to whatever they propose. So basically that means creating a class of people, creating a structure of institutions, and creating a process whereby Native consent has to happen. It may be delayed, there may be politics on the way, but in the end, when you have a class of people that are wholly dependent on your money to put food in their mouth, and when you have a set of institutions that are wholly funded by you, how long can those people hold out and say no when something you propose goes against their principles? You can't. And they know that. So that's why they get what they want all the time. What we're saying is, well, we're going to have a group of people working together who are not dependent on that system by commitment, and who are going to represent the true voice of the Native people. Sometimes it might agree with that comprador class. Most oftentimes I suspect it won't, and the government will be forced into having to explain and then justify why it is going with that group and not the mass of Native people who are not taking a paycheck from them. So to me, that's a good political objective. I've just given away our objective on the net here, but I think we're going to be pretty clear about it anyway.
Yeah, no, it's going to be, that's an important moment. It's really a propitious time for it to happen as well.
It's about the only thing we can do, actually. Yeah. And right now, we can't compete in terms of money.
Yeah.
We can't compete in terms of physical force.
Yeah. But it's occupying a different psychogeography, delegitimation, and a different, it's in fact creating a new coinage of symbolic exchange.
Yeah, it's kind of inspired by the essence of what Gandhi did. I mean, Gandhi's essence was to delegitimize the system and cause a withdrawal.
Yeah.
You know, you withdrew from the system, and the assumption is that Native participation in the empire is crucial.
But as one of the persons that you interviewed, who had a really good political analysis, saying, yeah, it's a different situation.
Mm-hmm.
He says Gandhi has the Indian population drawn. Basically,
mm-hmm.
He says you have 3% of the population drawn to begin with,
mm-hmm.
and a very small fraction, he went on to say, in a very small micro fraction of that 3%,
mm-hmm.
so it's a different situation.
The advantage we have over that, though, is they have the numbers they had the numbers in India.
Yeah.
We have all the power. Everybody who controls Indian affairs and the agenda is a native. And the only reason they're in there controlling things is because the assumption of their participation being a sign of consent. So the system needs their consent. If we can delegitimize them and show the Canadian public and prove that that there is no consent to this, then they're caught in their own logic.
Yeah, the German sociologist Jürgen Habermas would be very proud of you.
Oh, good. Well, my wife's half German too, so.
No, because it's a real Gramscian strategy of counter-legitimation. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I've read some Gramsci too, and not a lot, but I think you can boil down. Excuse me, Gramscians, not to insult you, but you can boil it down to that, you know, the organic intellectual and getting in the system and withdrawing later when it comes to depend on you.
Yeah, but your notion is even broader than that, because like in Lasasi, it really talks about if you're going to develop like a new group of native leadership, indigenous leadership, it has to also be based on people relearning language.
Yeah.
And I love the descriptions of the book, where I thought they were brilliant, where you describe the difference between having your psychological horizon as whites in our culture, as English cultures, and the naming of things through nouns and things like this, framing language of control, versus like Mohawk, a language is much more transitive in character and fluid. It's about you know, actions happening, Mohawk just doing sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. It's something that really shifts your way of thinking, even if you continue to operate in English. You know, it's like breaking the hold it has on you, and you can reinvent English. I think you can use English in a way that's different, but you first have to immerse yourself in that worldview, and you first have to come to see the world through that cultural lens of which language is the most powerful, most obvious way. But even if you're not fluent, you can consistently interact with it enough so that it kind of shifts your way of thinking, and you begin to use English differently, I think, and you begin to see things differently.
So it's really an emergent vision, actually, coming into the language, and it's based on spirituality, too.
Yeah.
And it's quite different than the evangelical fundamentalism that's happening in British Columbia and other places.
Oh, yeah, I mean, that's the competing movement. I don't see the state as competing for us in the long term. I mean, I see our real competition as Protestantism, evangelical fundamental Protestantism from the United States.
How could that possibly have taken hold?
Well, I mean,
the indigenous population, since it's essentially racist.
Well, I don't think that there's too much talk of politics because it's not in the United States.
Yeah.
You know, so the people who are promoting it don't care what happens here politically. Yeah. They just want people to be adhering to their religion, right? I mean, and there's an economic motivation for it, I guess.
Yeah.
But when it comes down to it, the whole political component to it, as it exists in the United States, is not present in Canada, at least not yet.
Yeah.
What they're trying to do is harness all of the alienation and the spiritual vacuum that exists in Native communities, which does. They're not Christian anymore for all intents and purposes because of the experience with residential school. The Anglican and the Catholic Church completely abused and wasted the opportunity they had, even from their own perspective, to create a community of indigenous people, like in Mexico, who were staunchly Catholic or Anglican, by allowing the systematic sex abuse of little children by priests. So they're bankrupt. Financially now, the Anglicans are in those communities, but also spiritually and politically. So that's gone. The Native culture, as a result of that failed project, has been bankrupted as well. It's been broken in terms of the spiritual universe. Most people are Christianized. They don't understand their own culture anymore. You have a situation now where people are coming and re-traditionalizing, but as I critiqued in my second book, it's not authentic in a lot of cases. It's done as a cloak, as a cover, and people see right through it. They see abuse happening. They see a lot of things happening with the cloak of traditionalism, and they're turned off by that. So they either can't connect or they're turned off by it. And what do you have? You have a complete vacuum, religiously and spiritually, and that causes all the kind of alcohol. It exacerbates. The root causes the loss of land and dispossession, but it exacerbates it. And you have a perfect situation for someone with a very clear, redeeming charismatic religion to come in, to say you were a sex abuser, you were an alcoholic, you were a cocaine dealer last week. All you have to do is accept Jesus and you're all clean and you can be a good person and you can be the pillar of your community next week simply by getting baptized. Hey, that's the attraction of Christianity all around the world, I think, you know? So it's just more profound and intense in these situations. Yeah, and you have these people who say, hey, I'm no longer the colonized subject. I'm saved and I'm a good person. And you understand the human instinct, of course. You sympathize with it. But you can't agree with the process of further dislocation culturally from who they are. I mean, it's colonial. I have relatives and friends who are born again Christians, and I understand why they want to do it. And I sympathize with them. But at the same time, I say, you know, I can't agree with what's going on. I'm going to have to go against it too. You know, like spiritual battle.
Well, it's true. Because it was, for what society is, an effective political movement couldn't just involve delegitimation.
No.
It has to be a spiritual movement.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's said explicitly in there, but it's quite obvious to anyone who reads it and thinks about it, like you're saying, is that it's really it's a spiritual movement, not in a mystical sense or a prophetic sense. It may be characterized that way by some people, but it's not spiritual in the sense that it helps a person recover who she or he is and gain some confidence, some security, and a whole personality. And it stabilizes them psychologically and spiritual in that sense, you know, and it gives them a feeling of power and rootedness.
Yeah.
And then
based on traditional teachings, like the two wampum.
The two wampum.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, all of those things are real important. And there's, I mean, in my own life, in the life of our students here, it's no longer this kind of insulated national existence of saying, here, Mohawks do this, Crees do that, Dene do this, Ojibwe. It's not that way anymore in reality. Because of the way our mobility patterns are and the way we live, you know, there's an indigenous kind of a spirituality and there's an indigenous culture, and everybody's proud of where they come from and what nation they're from, and it's more of a sense of everybody has something to contribute. So the Haudenosaunee, the Iroquois, have this piece. The Cree have this piece. The Ojibwe's have this piece, and the younger Native people look at it that way. You know, so sweat lodge is great because it does this for you, and that's one element. You know, pipe ceremony is great, it does this for you. The Iroquois teachings on the great law and the condolence do this for you. And they just seamlessly integrate all of these things. So that's where the word indigenous comes from. It's not meant to say that our own nationhood and our own culture doesn't matter. It's to say that it's being integrated into a larger identity and a larger idea. And to me, that's great because that's where it all comes from. The old, really old teachings are that there was a great, before colonial period, before the white man came, you know, there was a lot of interchange and exchange, and there was a lot of complementarity and sharing, and there was one big treaty. You listen to these old, really old people mouthing the old teachings, and they'll talk about how there was one treaty among the natives, and these were the principles that were agreed upon. And wars happened when people went against those. But in essence, you had a society created among people based on the basic principles that we all share. And these ceremonies are just reflections of that. And you can look at the pipe ceremony and the sweat lodge and the condolence as just the cultural manifestations of the same principle. And that's kind of the idea of spirituality that I'm trying to bring back here. Because of myself, never been really knowledgeable or immersed enough in one in particular to be parochial or chauvinistic about one.
Yeah.
So it's maybe a reflection of that. But I think that I've heard enough from elders and from other people in other nations about this to really be confident.
No, that's good. Because it's based on a notion of grand reunification.
Yeah.
Communities and beliefs.
Yeah. That's the central message of all of the teachings anyway. You know, when you're looking at the pipe ceremony and the sweat lodge and the great law, the Iroquois great law, they're all about unity when it boils down to it. Yeah, the need for unity.
Yeah. Other questions?
No, I think that's...
Thank you so much, Tayaki.
Well, thanks for asking. Yeah, that's great.
It's fabulous.
Wonderful.
For senior readers, this is really a wonderful moment. It's great. Yeah, so we also look forward to further reports about Wasasse, the organization's political movement, which is really significant, and also to a return interview sometime about what happens in the urban.
Oh, yeah, sure, okay.
We'll leave that dangling for the
moment. All right, that's a good one.
Thanks, Tayaki.
All right.
Thanks.
Yeah.